Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nick Neihardt of the group Public Campaign, who discusses proposed legislation to minimize the impact of the recent Supreme Court decision allowing unlimited spending by corporations in U.S. election campaigns. Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, who challenges President Obama's support for building more nuclear power plants as a way to reduce global warming. And Daniel Ellsberg, a former U.S. government military analyst, best known for his unauthorized release of the Vietnam-era Pentagon Papers, who reflects on the life and work of his late friend, historian Howard Zinn. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
U.S. military and intelligence agents have been deployed in covert operations inside Yemen that since mid-December has reportedly killed half the top leadership of the local affiliates of Al-Qaeda. Several dozen American soldiers assist the clandestine Joint Special Operations Command in Yemen, reports the Washington Post. U.S. personnel are deeply involved in planning missions, developing military tactics, and providing weapons and munitions. During a December 24th raid, Yemen soldiers raided a compound where an American citizen, Anwar al-Aluki, was meeting with regional Al-Qaeda operatives. Al-Aluki has since been put on a short list of Americans targeted to be killed or captured by the Special Operations Command. Yemen's president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, has been an ally of the American war on terrorism since the attacks on September 11, 2001. President Saleh has given his approval for drone flights over Yemen to kill Al-Qaeda militants. Over the last year, the Obama administration has increased the number of drone missile attacks against militants in Pakistan and along the Afghan border. Under Obama, there have been more drone attacks than during the last 3 years of the George W. Bush administration combined. On March 1, 2009, Friends of the Earth Nigeria received an urgent call about a fire at the site of a major oil spill at a Shell pipeline in the Niger Delta. The fire was raging in an area only weeks earlier environmentalists had requested to be cleaned up. Over the last year, Friends of the Earth has documented 9 oil spills at Shell facilities in Ikarma, Nigeria. The oil spills have contaminated the area's main source of water and killed most of the fish there. The fire last March also destroyed many local crops. The World Wildlife Foundation estimates the oil industry in the Niger Delta spills 1.5 million tons of oil a year, the equivalent of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. According to The Nation magazine, Shell Petroleum, a division of Royal Dutch Shell, consistently blames sabotage by local independence rebels for the oil spills, while Niger activists blame oil contractors for lighting the oil fires. A toxic brew of crude oil, poverty, and corruption has long afflicted the Niger Delta. In the mid-1990s, writer-activist Ken Saro Wiwa emerged to challenge Shell and the Nigerian military. Saro Wiwa and several supporters were executed after a tribunal. Last August, Saro Wiwa's family settled a long-running case against Shell for $15.5 million in damages. After the hanging of Saro Wiwa, Shell pledged to reform its operations. The oil giant signed the Voluntary Principles on Security and Human Rights, a move hailed by leading human rights groups. Still, ecological conditions in the Delta continue to deteriorate. The Democratic Socialists of America chapter in southeastern Michigan has helped mobilize a swing constituency for Democrats in state legislative elections, even though it has been shunned by consultants from the Democratic National Committee. David Green, chair of the 250-member DSA chapter, told the news magazine In These Times, the key is building reliable relationships with state and local Democratic Party officials, which have evolved over the last decade. A case in point is the 2004 race for state representative won by Latino activist John Espinoza in a region traditionally held by Republicans. Green says the key is to focus on races that are winnable, but activists working on campaigns downplay their socialist DSA affiliation. With its success, the DSA chapter and the local candidates it supports have been targets of a red-baiting campaign. In 2009, the Michigan-based free market Mackinac Center for Public Policy launched an attack on the DSA by proclaiming, "Are socialists deciding close house races?" Despite the attack, all the DSA-endorsed candidates won close races against Republicans who launched a late blitz of robocalls. Still, the red baiting has stopped the DSA chapter from getting into higher-profile congressional races, and staffers from the Democratic National Committee have refused to accept the organization's support in several races. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
When President Obama delivered his State of the Union address to Congress on January 27th, he surprised many observers by directly criticizing the Supreme Court majority, whose justices were seated directly before him, for their ruling in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case. By a 5-4 decision, the court decided to overturn 100 years of law to remove restrictions on campaign spending by corporations, labor unions, and nonprofit groups, declaring these limits violated the First Amendment's free speech principles. In his speech, Obama said, "I don't think American elections should be bankrolled by America's most powerful interests, or worse, by foreign entities." Obama then urged Congress to pass legislation that helps to right this wrong. To that end, a number of proposals have been raised to mitigate the impact of the court's decision. They include measures to give shareholders more power over corporate political spending, require companies that pay for candidate advertising to identify themselves, and restrict corporations with big government contracts from buying campaign ads. Other groups are promoting an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would establish that money is not speech and that human beings, not corporations, are entitled to constitutional rights. Another approach being put forward would establish a system of publicly funded elections. The Fair Elections Now Act, introduced in both the House and Senate, would encourage federal candidates to raise a large number of small contributions from their communities in order to qualify for public funds for their campaigns. Matching funds would be available to candidates facing well-financed opponents or who are targeted by local or national groups. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nick Neihardt, president and CEO of the group Public Campaign, who explains the impact of the Supreme Court decision and how the Fair Elections Now Act could be an immediate remedy.
There are a number of good proposals out there. We think the one that will go the furthest in the shortest time is the Fair Elections Now Act, and that's a bill that is similar to the system that exists in Connecticut, Arizona, Maine, and for some offices in several other states as well, that allows candidates to run for office solely with small contributions. The federal version of the bill basically says that if you want to run for the U.S. House or Senate, you do so. Again, you can enter into this voluntarily, so it's constitutional. You can do so on the basis of just contributions of $100 or less. That gets you a fixed amount of money to campaign with, about the average it costs to win that same race right now. But if you need more money, if these outside expenditures come in against you or you have a very wealthy opponent, your option is to continue collecting small donations, again, only $100 or less, but they're matched 4-1 from a public fund, and that enables a candidate to compete on the basis of just small donations. And we think once small donations are matched and candidates begin to focus on small gifts from ordinary people, that there'll be enough money, again, with the federal match, so that a candidate can compete fairly against a fair amount of this big money that may be flooding in.
With the Fair Elections Now Act, does it have a strong base of sponsors in Congress, and what are the chances for passage? Are those chances increased by this Supreme Court decision with a lot of alarm by candidates who are going to be running for office this November to get something passed quickly?
Yeah, I mean, let me just start by saying in the House, where the lead sponsor of the bill is Connecticut's Congressman John Larson, who is the chair of the House Democratic Caucus, he has 129 co-sponsors right now with him on the bill. So you start out at 130, close to two-thirds of the amount you need to win the bill overall. And there's been an increase in interest in the bill since the Citizens United decision because candidates are wondering, what am I going to do when I have to raise even more money than I do now? Do I really want to spend that much more time calling wealthy donors from all over the country, not from my district, spending less time campaigning and less time on the issues that I was sent to Washington to deal with? And so there is a sense of we need change. They look at all the polling, and it shows voters want a Washington that's not controlled by special interests. Right now, over 80% of voters believe that Washington is dominated, legislation is dominated by special interest influence. And they're right, of course. And so there's already a solid base of support. Candidates are looking for a way to go, a way out of the current situation. So there is increased interest as a result of the Citizens United decision. And then I know the next question is, well, what do you do about the Senate? And the leader for this bill in the Senate is the number two Democrat, Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois, and he says the first thing we can do that will put them on the road to winning in the Senate is a victory in the House. That will put pressure on the Senate. And then I think you're looking at history where a handful of Republicans have always joined the majority of Democrats, not all Democrats, but a majority, to put a bill over the top. So first battle is the House. The next is the Senate. There are other good measures out there, and I think people are right to take a look at, in the long term, a constitutional amendment. But that requires two-thirds of each chamber of Congress to pass it, and then you've got to win it in three-quarters of the state. So I think that's an important project, but it's longer term, and we need relief now.
Generally speaking, you know, I think there's a perception that the Republicans welcome the Supreme Court decision because they generally support the corporate agenda on a host of issues, and this could be a huge boon to them in a critical election year in November 2010. What do you make of how this is going to play out in terms of the urgency maybe on the part of Democrats to blunt the Supreme Court decision versus Republicans feeling they should defend it?
Well, I think it puts Democrats in a particularly difficult position because if they look at the key issues that helped sweep them into office in 2008, the mandate for change from voters, for change on health care, for coping with global climate change, for changing our energy economy, for regulating the banks and the big Wall Street powers, they're caught now because they've championed these issues. There hasn't been that much change coming out of Washington, at least so far in the first year. And if they keep championing those issues, they know that they're going to be under the gun for money and maybe not have any victories to take back home to the voters. So I think they're going to be desperate and looking for a way out of this money race.
That was Nick Neihardt, president and CEO of the group Public Campaign. Contact the coalition of more than 35 groups advocating public campaign financing at area code 202-293-0222 or visit their website at fairelectionsnow.org. In his State of the Union address on January 27th, President Obama called for an increase in federal loan guarantees to build new nuclear power plants, which he said would help produce clean energy and address the problem of climate change. He made the proposal despite a recent rash of leaks of radioactive tritium at 27 of the nation's 104 nuclear reactors, and despite his administration's decision to end the decades-long push to store nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain in Nevada without an alternative site. Obama has appointed a commission to study the issue, but has not appointed any critics of nuclear power to sit on the panel. In reaction to his support for nuclear power, proponents of clean energy technologies sent thousands of letters to the president demanding he withdraw his proposed federal loan guarantees to build new nuclear reactors. Opponents assert that nuclear power will only worsen the planet's climate change crisis by diverting tens of billions of dollars that could otherwise be spent on safe, clean, cost-effective energy sources. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Michael Marriott, executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, about the administration's push for more nuclear plants, despite candidate Obama's opposition to taxpayer subsidies for nuclear power and concerns about the technology's safety.
It's a political move. It's not because much of the administration is so gung-ho on nuclear, with the possible exception of Energy Secretary Chu. It's that the administration and Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts are convinced the only way to get a climate bill through the Senate is to load a lot of nuclear, offshore oil, and clean coal pork onto the bill to try to get Republican support for it. It's a very damaging move because these loan guarantees are a real risk for taxpayers. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that 50% of new nuclear projects that use these guarantees are going to fail. And that's going to put taxpayers on the hook for billions and billions of dollars.
Some loan guarantees were included in the Energy Act of 2005, but they're just becoming available now. But Obama's talking about much higher funding. Can you talk about these two different sources?
In 2007, Congress approved $18.5 billion in loan guarantees for construction of new reactors, along with another $2 billion for construction of a uranium enrichment facility. None of that money has been spent. None of it will be spent for another couple of years because no reactors, no utilities have licenses to build new reactors, and they're not going to for the next couple of years. The Department of Energy is hoping to issue some conditional loan guarantees in the near future. They're hoping to get the first one out in the next few weeks. But these will be conditional upon, A, the reactor design being certified by the NRC, and the designs are not yet certified, and B, the utility actually getting a license to build the plant, which is no certainty either, despite the fact that it will be 2-3 years or more before any of these loan guarantees can actually go out the door. The president's new budget would supply another $36 billion in loan guarantees for new reactors. That makes a total of $54.5 billion if you're counting. Again, this money won't go out the door for years. There's no urgency for it. We don't even know if the program's going to work. A, it's just sort of silly to allocate this money and tie up this money when there are renewable energy projects ready to go out the door, ready to start work right now. It's a big mistake. It's a mistake that doesn't have to happen. Our Congress does have to approve this money, and there are certainly some Congress members who are not going to look favorably on this. And, of course, the utilities have to get licenses to build their reactors, and that's not a certainty either. So there's a long way to go in this fight. We're just at the beginning stages right now.
Michael Marriott, at least some environmentalists who are very concerned about climate change, have been calling for phasing out coal-fired power plants and turning to so-called fourth-generation nuclear plants as a way to provide clean energy. The climate scientist James Hansen is one of those people calling for that. They say renewable sources alone can't reduce carbon emissions quickly enough.
The choice is not coal or nuclear. The choice is nuclear or renewables. We don't need any more coal. We need to close existing coal plants. I mean, that's a given for anybody concerned about climate change. And I don't know anybody concerned about climate change who doesn't agree with that. The question is, how are we going to get our power in the future, and how is it going to reduce carbon emissions in the most effective, most financially responsible, safest and cleanest way possible? Nuclear power fails those tests. We have limited resources, as we all know. If we try the all-of-the-above strategy that is promoted by the nuclear power industry, we will end up with none of the above, essentially. We will end up with a weak program that cannot achieve the kinds of carbon reductions we need. The so-called fourth generation of reactors are 20 to 30 years away. They will have no role to play in the speedy reduction of carbon emissions. But spending money on them now, that money could and should be used for supporting those technologies that we know work. 30 years ago, 20 years ago even, probably even 10 years ago, renewables weren't ready to shoulder the load. We didn't have the capacity in this country or worldwide to build enough solar and wind and geothermal and, you know, other types of renewable energy to meet our electricity needs. But that has changed, particularly when you combine it with energy efficiency measures, implementation of a smart grid, which didn't even exist 10 years ago, distributed generation policies. Those are the 21st century energy technologies that can quickly reduce carbon emissions and that will power our future.
That was Michael Marriott of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Contact the group's Maryland office at area code 301-270-6477 or visit their website at nirs.org. Historian and activist Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States, which has sold nearly 2 million copies, died on January 27th. Throughout his career, Zinn chronicled the history of our nation from a perspective that discarded the jingoism and triumphalism that characterizes most other standard works of American history. What made his writing so compelling is that he wrote about world events, not from the perspective of kings, queens, presidents, and corporate CEOs, but rather from regular people who are the true engines of history. MIT professor Noam Chomsky, a longtime friend, said Zinn's writings changed the perspective and understanding of history for a whole generation. Professor Zinn not only wrote about history, he was a participant in shaping history through his uncompromising advocacy for peace and social justice. After serving in the Army Air Corps as a bombardier during World War II, he became chair of the history department at Spelman College, a historically black institution for women in Atlanta, where he planned and participated in civil rights protests. From the Vietnam War era to Ronald Reagan's covert wars in Central America to the Bush, both father and son's wars in the Persian Gulf, Zinn was no stranger to activism, police batons, tear gas, and jail cells, often putting himself at risk for his beliefs. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Daniel Ellsberg, a former government military analyst who, in 1971, leaked the now-famous Vietnam War era Pentagon Papers to the press. The documents chronicle the lies and deceit employed by the government to justify U.S. military intervention in Southeast Asian wars. Here, Ellsberg reflects on the life and work of his late friend Howard Zinn, whom he describes as his hero.
He is known now, I think, among many people for talking more about the dark side of American history than others do, certainly, than other historians do. But that was in the interest, I believe, of encouraging people to realize the difference between our ideals that we're taught, which are very admirable ones, ideals of freedom and justice in this country, independence, and decency, and how far those are often from our practice in the interest of getting Americans to be responsible, to feel responsible, to act responsibly, to change that when we're doing wrong. When we're my country right or wrong, as someone said, when it's wrong to be set right. And that was Howard's career in life, in particular, to not just to celebrate the things we do right, but to recognize the things we do wrong now and in the past, and realize that we are able, as American citizens, more than people in many other countries, to act together freely to set our country right.
Daniel Ellsberg, In a piece you wrote shortly after Howard Zinn's death, titled A Memory of Howard, you said that Howard Zinn was your hero, that he was the best human being you've ever known. Tell us about the personal side.
Of course, that's a very strong statement. I've never made it before about anybody, I would say. I was just thinking about it because our paths have crossed several times recently in this documentary film that he's in. And thinking about how I felt about him. And just, I think the thing I said at the beginning, I have a lot of heroes, and he's not the only one. And yet he was the first name that came to my mind when somebody asked me recently who my heroes were. Howard was an advocate of nonviolent civil disobedience, took part with me in a number of actions and many others where I was not involved. And he believed that that was part of our democracy, that the regular, ordinary processes of voting and lobbying and writing letters and whatnot did not exhaust our responsibilities as citizens, and that the system didn't work by itself without a kind of pressure that would recall people to their consciences or their consciences to them. When I did expect the FBI to be coming after me because the Pentagon Papers were coming out in the New York Times that evening, it was June 12th, 1971, and I had just gotten word that they were coming out, so I found myself with a copy of the Pentagon Papers, these top secret documents, in my apartment, and I'd been very careful not to have them in my own apartment for months, or ever really. I kept them elsewhere, lest they be snatched away by the FBI. So here I had these things, and I had to get rid of them quickly. And Howard was the person I knew. I could have turned to Noam Chomsky, I think, but Howard I was going to see that night, to see Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in Howard Square. So I called him up and said I had something wanted to stash with him. And in fact, I had already given him a large part of it to read. He was historian, and I thought he ought to have these documents for his own information. So that was another set. So, of course, he agreed right away.
What is the legacy that he leaves behind? And what's the inspiration he leaves current generations?
Of course, his book, I will remember when I asked him years ago, around 1980 or so, what he was working on. He said, well, it's something very modest. I'm writing a history of the United States. He said, joking. And he said, I'm going to call it a people's history of the United States. Well, it ended up, of course, with a book that has sold 2 million copies around the world. He leaves a legacy of this people's history, which is a history, above all, of resistance struggles, of showing that people can, even without much reason for hope, can get together and act to change things nonviolently.
That was Daniel Ellsberg, whose release of the Pentagon Papers in 1971 bolstered opposition to the Vietnam War. Read more about the life and work of Professor Zinn at howardzinn.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.